so that you can make those decisions. Yeah.
Just a sec. I wanted to say something about that, which is that I went to school after high school three times, and I hated two of them. The first one was because I got a scholarship, and because if you go to calculus in high school, then you're supposed to go to engineering school. And I actually tried to transfer out of the Colorado School of Mines to the University of Colorado to take writing, and I went into the registrar's office, and the registrar said, wait a second, you have a scholarship to the School of Mines, and you want to transfer to the University of Colorado in English? Are you out of your mind? And I was like, well, okay. And then I went back to School of Mines. And then the second time, then I went to graduate school for 1 year because I had a year of eligibility left for high jumping. And this is a terrible reason to go to school, too. And that was just miserable. But then I went back when I was 29 or 28 or something. I went back and I got an MFA in creative writing. And the reason I went to school then is because I had learned as much as I could from dead writers. And I wanted to learn how to write better, and I wanted to have a teacher who could talk back, as opposed to, I can't ask Dostoevsky questions, you know? I can, but I'm not always sure of the answers. And, of course, that's true from reading his books, too. And I loved it. And part of the reason I loved it is because I took absolute control of my own education. I said, you know what? You don't offer a playwriting minor? I want a playwriting minor. So how do we make this happen? And I never would have had the confidence to do that in high school, in college, the first time. And besides which, I hated science anyway, so... and the only good thing I got out of my degree in science is now I'm a strong critic of science. I think science is bullshit. And then I'll say science is bullshit, and people will say, oh my God, that's blasphemy. I'm like, oh yeah, I have a bachelor's in science, a bachelor's in mineral engineering physics from Colorado School of Mines, and your degree is in communications? So let's talk about science for a while. So it gives me some credibility, you know, but it's just bullshit. Yeah, it's a BS in mineral engineering physics with an emphasis in BS. So yeah, just I want to echo what they both said about taking charge, but there's also the fact that you're then what, 19?
18.
And so I have a couple questions, and these are rhetorical. I don't expect you to have answers right now. I would not have had these answers. I would have hated my books if I read them at 18. At 18, I would have thought I was some sort of fucking communist pinko agitator bad guy. Does that mean that you agree that I'm a communist pinko agitator?
I like communists.
Okay. This was a bad thing when I was 18. I voted for Ronald Reagan when I was 19, for crying out loud. And
I voted for Nixon.
Huh,
I beat you.
So if I would have read my books in high school, I would have hated them. In college, they would have troubled me and I wouldn't have understood them. By the time I was a senior in college, I would have needed them. And by the time I was 24, 25, I would have been hungry for them. So, you know, my point is that we evolve. But I'm going to ask these questions just to plant them. First one is, what are the largest, most pressing problems you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? What are the largest, most pressing problems you can help to solve using the gifts that are unique to you and all the universe? That may change over time. You know, and I wouldn't have been able to say, you know, when I was 18, I would not have been able to say what they are. But now I can say what they are. There's a huge hole in our discourse. There's a hole in discourse. There are 2 million dams in the United States, 70,000 dams over 13 feet tall, 60,000 dams over 13 feet tall, 70,000 dams over 6.5 feet tall. If we only took out one of those dams every day, it would take 200 years to take out those dams. Salmon don't have that time and sturgeon don't have that time. I looked around, I saw a big hole in our discourse. I didn't see any environmentalists talking about fighting back. I didn't see anybody talking about how this culture is psychopathological. I didn't see very many people, I didn't see any men making the connections between rape and environmental degradation. Women, I didn't see any men doing it. Okay, there's my job. I got my task laid out for me. And I couldn't have done that at 18. And the other thing is, and also this would have changed over time, is what do you get off on? What do you get off on doing? I mean, one of the reasons I've written so many books is because I get off on doing what I do. And that's different than what do you love. You know, I love the salmon. I know that's really deep and meaningful and everything. It's like, what do you get off on? It's much more just, what do you get off on doing? And it's like I was hanging out with this wetland specialist. I love this story. Hanging out with this wetland specialist. We were working together to stop a subdivision. Development's another word I don't like. Working together to stop a subdivision and to stop the murder of some trees. And he was digging in the dirt, and they'd rub his fingers between the, rub the soil between his fingers, and they would compare the color of the soil to a chart, and that would help him determine whether these are wetland soils. And I looked at him and I said, "Do you get off on doing this?" He said, "Oh, yeah. This is my second favorite thing to do in the world after playing with my dogs." And I said, "Well, that's great, because this would be hell for me. On the other hand, I've condemned myself to a life of homework, you know? I get off on trying to figure out the relationship between perceived entitlement, exploitation, and atrocity. I mean, I get so excited by, like, that stuff that I wrote, that I read. You know, that was the best part of the whole airplane trip, which, you know, frankly, it was an airplane trip. It's not very fun anyway. But, you know, it's just, I get off on trying to figure out how it is, this is the book I'm working on right now, how it is that if indigenous peoples have had really intense and good relationships with beings on other sides, how is it that the dominant culture has always been able to kill them? And how is it that if the earth really is intelligent, which I fully believe, if the earth is sentient, why hasn't it killed us off? Mm-hmm. It's like, goddamn, why did smallpox go the wrong direction? And why did, you know, it's so, it just pisses me off. You know, October 12th is Columbus Day, and
Invaders Day.
Yeah, exactly. And the day of mourning.
Yes, exactly.
And did you know that there was a mutiny on Columbus's ship? Do you know this? A mutiny on Columbus's ship on October 11th. And they said, "We're going back." And he said, "Give me one more day." Oh. Fuck! God damn, you know? I mean, why that fucking day? And it was moonlight. You know, they saw moonlight shining off the beach. Why wasn't it cloudy that night? Tell me that. Why wasn't it cloudy? Or there were so many attempts made to kill Hitler. So many attempts. It's like a Monty Python movie where he's walking around and there's just like, you know, swords falling behind him. He doesn't see him. There was an attempt on Hitler's life made that failed because a fly landed on somebody's hand. For real. That might make that up. Because a fly landed on somebody's hand, the attempt failed. There were times where they put bombs in a plane of Hitler's, and he took off, and they were altitude dependent to go off. And the timers went off. I'm not the timers. The what's it called? The explosives. The detonators. The detonators went off. Didn't set off the explosives. Another time, Hitler was in Russia, and some tanks were able to break through the German lines. And they got up to the airport where Hitler was going to take off. They ran out of gas at the edge of the airport. It's like something's going on here, you know. And so that's the book I'm doing right now. I totally get off on trying to figure out. Okay, so I'm going to give some of my answers real quick. One of the answers, maybe science is right, and the world really is dead. And just humans are the only intelligence in the entire universe. Everything else is just dead matter. And so when the Indians were praying, they were just praying to nobody, you know? And when I say, why hasn't the earth fought back? That's like asking why the toolbox doesn't, you know, bite you when you try to reach in for a wrench, you know? Maybe science is right. I don't think so, but maybe. That's one possibility. Maybe the Christians are right. You know, maybe there's only one God, and maybe he's just one nasty motherfucker. You know? He's like, the Christian God, he's a really bad piece of work, you know? And besides, he's really weird. Okay, first off, he's omniscient, he's omnipotent, he's the only God, and he's jealous? It's like...
And there's a devil.
Get some counseling, dude. You know? So maybe the Christians are right, you know? And there's only one God, and he just... And you know why he's so pissed off? You know why he hates bodies so much? Because he's several billion years old, and he doesn't have a body, which means he's never had an orgasm. It's like, that is a long fucking time to go without an orgasm. So he's just pissed. It's like, they're having an orgasm. That's bad. Or maybe there are a lot of gods, but just the Christian God was strong. Or maybe God's a machine, because, you know, the machines are really winning. I mean, machines are winning. We are serving the machines. I mean, we think that this culture is actually winning. We're dying of fucking cancer, you know? But the machines are proliferating everywhere. So God's this big fucking machine. Like, he's a big bulldozer or something, you know? I mean, I don't know. I'm throwing out those. I actually don't think those are the ideas. The real truth, and this is where I'm just about to write this, what I really think it is that I think that the dominant culture has been much better at gaining sacrifices. You have to give things to these other beings to. I mean, there's an exchange. You give them something. And I think that all the women who are raped, I think all the species who are driven extinct, I think those are sacrifices to nasty forces who don't wish us well. I think the dominant culture sacrifices all those beings to some bad ones. I don't know. That's my best guess. I don't know. But the point is, I get off on trying to figure that out. So I am going to give you some advice, which is, whether you stay in school or not, I actually don't care. I don't think that's the important question. I can say that because I'm not in school. My advice to you would be, whether you stay in school or not, that you spend the next 5 or 6 years figuring out what you love enough that you would live your life for it, and what you love enough that you would die for it, and what you love enough that you would that you will spend your life in service to. And also to figure out, so three things. What do you love enough that you would, like, I love the salmon. I would give my life for the salmon in a heartbeat. What do you love enough that you will live your life in service to? I know women who, I know the woman who used to run the battered women's program for the state of New York. She's relentless. Every man she sees, she asks, what will it take for men to stop beating on women? Get in a taxi cab with this woman. She says, I'd like to go to Central Park. What will it take for men to stop beating on women? Do not get on the subway with this woman. I mean, she's relentless. And what is there that you feel so strongly about? You know, and frankly, when I was 18, 19, what I felt strongly enough about was high jumping. And that's okay, you know? But for then, I lived my life. That's what got me through college, was I loved high jumping so much. And so what is there that you love? Because it's your life. It's not my life. It's not your life. It's not your life. It's not your life. It's not your parents' life. It's not your counselor's life. It's not your teacher's life. It's your life. You're the one who's got to live with it, and you got to live with the results. So what do you love, first? Second, what do you get off on? And third, what are your gifts? And so my advice to you, in fact, my directive to you, is to, no matter what you do, figure those out. That is your job right now. Does that help at all?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, one more thing. It can change. It can change.
It will change.
It will change. I used to think that it should be a law that nobody should get married at 20. It's like, if you get married at 20, you deserve what happens to you. Because I dated one woman all through my 20s, and we were long distance for about 2 years in the middle, and then when we got back together, she said to me one time as we were breaking up, she said, you know, I used to think that I knew you better than you knew yourself, and now I don't even know who you are. And I remember what I thought in that moment was, I'm really glad, because I didn't like who I was when I was 20. And so I'm glad that you don't know who I am anymore, because I'm not the same person I was that when we were together before. And we changed so much. Somebody over here was going to ask something. You were going to pick somebody. I interrupted you.
I don't know. There were several people. Go ahead.
When you were talking about different housing cooperative places to live, like North Carolina and all the different places, Gainesville, and you're talking a lot about like what you're willing to do and how you're willing to live, I guess I'm just wondering what your thoughts are if you bring like a class analysis into that, because I don't think a lot of people have choice. Can't really like will yourself into like go living on a co-op if you're, you know, living in poverty with a bunch of kids or something. So I guess to me, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems like if I take what you're saying and follow that path, unless you can like mix it up a little, it seems like you're saying like what we need to do, what's wrong with our society is, you know, have some sort of exodus from capitalism, like just leave it, have alternative institutions and go do that, and it'll go away, and we can all do that if we want to badly enough. And like for me, I think we need to confront capitalism, the state, and we need to fight it. I don't think everyone has the privilege to make the choices you've made, for instance, or the choices I've made. So I'm just wondering, like, so I'm not assuming that what you're saying, if you can maybe speak to that a little bit.
Well, first of all, I come from, I guess, the middle class, although neither of my parents went to college, and I was told at my community by someone that I could not be middle class if neither one of my parents went to college. That was their definition of middle class. So my idea about cooperative living, okay, and it is opposed at a certain place to capitalism, because what we're attempting to do is live a more non-exploitive life, and that's part of the way I define capitalism, as something that is an exploitation-based lifestyle. So for me, a cooperative lifestyle is different than a capitalist lifestyle, and I don't think that they're mutually exclusive. I think that you can live a simple cooperative lifestyle and still work against capitalism. and challenge capitalism and get arrested at the World Bank and whatever. I think all that can happen simultaneously. The advantage of practicing a different economic format or a different way of looking at things or a different way of sharing things, this idea of access without ownership. What does that mean? But the more that we practice those things, the more real it is and the more we learn the details. That's why if I come and talk to people about living in a community that's off the grid, there's a lot of details in living in a community off the grid that just saying, well, you should just get solar panels and use insulated shades. For, you know, the details are there if you've lived that way. So if you choose to be vegetarian, which I've been vegetarian for 32 years, if you choose that, I know a lot of details about different aspects of vegetarian living from, you know, from the raw blah, blah, blah over here to the all these other aspects that we've done, to fasting, to whatever. So as you practice those things, you begin to get insight into what can work, what can't work, what you can change. I just think it gives you a better outlook on things because you're just more knowledgeable.
Well, I completely agree with you that, like, if we need other institutions to move into, we can't just, like, leave these and have nowhere to go. Like, if we're going to get rid of capitalism, of course, we need to figure out how we're going to live, how we're going to organize ourselves differently, and we're not just going to not organize ourselves. Mm-hmm. But I guess, like, my question to you is, obviously, like, creating and building and experimenting with alternative institutions to be living in, like, how do we get rid of this one that's oppressing so many people? Because that's going to help you, and that's going to help those however many people live on you know, the place where you live, where your shed is, and, like, their sheds, like, that's going to help all of them. But what about all of us? Like, we need to liberate all of us. Like, how do you see that?
I don't see us liberating all of us immediately. That may need to happen as push comes to shove and everything goes, and all the electricity goes off, which means all the computers goes off, which means all the gasoline can't be pumped, which means I don't know that everybody really knows how much of our lives is run on electricity. I mean, I live someplace where we're off the grid, so when all these rolling blackouts and stuff happen everywhere, it doesn't happen in our community. And so it's like if we're thinking in terms of down the line, our putting an example, for instance, out in our little community, which can be done in urban areas, and urban areas are doing these transition towns, and there's just so much going on. The whole Simple Living Network, which I've never seen, but which I hear is really good, is an introduction into all this stuff. And like I said, you don't stop living, you know, you don't stop everything at once. I work for social justice. I hire women that work in a transitional shelter or live there. I mean, I try to do a lot of things at once. And having a place like we have where people come and visit, they do tours, they get inspired. We have college classes coming through. We have high school classes coming through. People volunteer and they learn to make houses and stuff. I mean, this is like an educational format. It's not done like this because we're not that plugged in, but it's you don't have to do an either or thing. That's always
I'm not saying that at all. I think what you're saying is very important, but I think that I was just wondering how you see the rest of the struggle. Like, obviously what you're doing is part of the struggle. I'm just trying to understand
the rest of the struggle. You mean the stuff that other people are doing?
No, yeah, I guess. And maybe that's one way to look at it. Like, I'm doing this part and other people are doing another part. I guess, like, I'm wondering how you advocate for revolution, I guess.
Well, one way I advocate for revolution is through ostentatious underconsumption, is to just get people thinking about how we participate every day in supporting the dominant system, because it's through all of our support that everything continues to go on. So for me, the first thing to do is I'm an underminer. One of the things I really loved is I was reading about these anti-nuclear people in Germany, and they were really against the transportation of, you know, of nuclear waste. And instead of trying to overthrow something, they dug a tunnel under the highway. So the highway collapsed, so they couldn't run the nuclear waste back and forth. That's much more my tactic. Undermining is much more my tactic than this overthrowing thing. I'm not interested in that. How do I withdraw my support? How do I withdraw my tax dollars? How do I withdraw my energy? How do I help create a whole different energy field in looking at the way that we might be able to live together and be politically active and support people that are doing stuff that it's more direct action stuff? I mean, I think there's a wide variety of ways that people can attempt that, but for me, my lifestyle is first, because that gives me access to, even if we just pay attention to the way indigenous people live, and have a lot of potlucks and potlatches and share the wealth and give a bunch of stuff away like they did, that's a different way of looking at how we can interface with the rest of the world, I think.
I actually want to respond to this too.
I can see your mouth is open.
Yeah. And that's a really, really rich and important question on a bunch of levels. I want to answer a bunch of those levels, or insofar as I can. One of them is, I was sharing the stage with Karen Raffensperger, who's a good friend of mine, who's also a pacifist. And at one point, it was similar to this. And at one point, she was describing what a sustainable community would look like, and would smell like, and would feel like, and democratic decision-making processes. And the whole time, I'm doing the same thing I was doing here, which is... And finally, she turns to me and she says, so it's very clear you want to say something, Derek. And I said, yeah, this is all great. You're describing what it's going to look like. But right now, those in power are psychopaths. And if we have this democratic community that you're talking about, and there are resources on that land that those in power want, they will take them. They will kill you and they will take them. So how do we get there from here? And she smiled at me very sweetly and said, that's your job to describe, Derek. And the point is, we have different roles. That you're describing that, and I'm talking about bringing this motherfucker down. And so I don't believe in the reform versus revolution dichotomy. And one reason I don't, or the place I was where I learned it was when I used to teach at Pelican Bay State Prison, which is a supermax. And I recognized every day that I walked in there, I was participating in the biggest racist gulag on the planet. And at the same time, a lot of my students were telling me that the only things that were keeping them sane were our classes. And so how do I join with that? At that moment, the revolution versus reform dichotomy fell apart for me, because if we all wait for the great glorious revolution, which I am working every moment of my life for, that is what my life is about. Everything is about the pre-revolutionary phase. I mentioned the Battle of Algiers. Everything in my life, I am a recruiter for the revolution. I want to bring this thing down. I want to do it using any means necessary. Everything is about organizing for that. And we need to have organized resistance. We need to bring down this whole system. And at the same time, the fighters need to eat. And I'm going to look over at you. Because, you know, you can't... Once again, we need all that. And so that's another thing. The class analysis is... another thing that I wrote down here on the plane was, who will do it? Because I was doing a talk in Portland about a month ago, and this one woman said, you know, I want for the dams to come out, but I'm scared of state repression, and I don't want to do it, and who's going to do it? And my answer to her was, one thing we need to not do is we need to make sure that we don't put the indigenous on the front line yet again. And we need to not put the poor on the front line yet again, because they're always the fucking cannon fodder for everybody. And what I wrote on the plane was, who will do it? The middle class have the luxury to do this. It's not the job of the poor or the otherwise oppressed. They're too busy staying simply alive. It is our job. There was a guy came up to me years and years ago after I wrote The Culture of Make-Believe. And he said, he was a black guy, and he was really mad at me. He said, you know, you were able to write and publish this book because you're white. I said, yeah. He said, well, they wouldn't have published this if I wrote it. And I said, no, they probably wouldn't. He said, well, you're white, and you wrote it. I said, yeah, I did, and that's why. Because if you are a member of an oppressor class, it is not the responsibility of any members of the oppressed classes to differentiate you from others of the oppressors.
That's right.
It is not your job as a woman to differentiate me from other men. It is my job as a male to differentiate myself. Where I realized this was talking to Darja Mail. I was thinking about going to, I was just sort of putting myself in his place. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go to Iraq and I'm going to say, hey, I don't like the American invasion. I want to help you. You know, it's like, it wouldn't be their fault if they shoot me the first day there, because I'm an American. And it is my responsibility to differentiate myself. That's true on a class level. And this is one of the reasons why universities get shut down in Latin America, used to get shut down in Latin American countries, is because that's where a lot of action happened, is where you have people who have the luxury, as I do, to learn how to read. On a global level, everyone in this room is extraordinarily wealthy because we have been taught how to read and write. And that makes us extraordinarily wealthy. And it is our responsibility to use that privilege to undercut its basis. And so what happens is, a lot of times, at the university become hotbeds of revolution, because you would get the people who had the luxury to do the theorizing would come together with those who lived directly under the iron boot of oppression. And that's where the magic occurs. It's like, I got a book coming out in 2 weeks. It's a novel about a character who is quite a bit like me, except she's a female, and she's a paper revolutionary. She knows the system is all fucked up, and she talks about it's fucked up. She works on toxic issues on inner city. And one night on the way home from work, she's waiting for the bus, and she gets mugged. And she's kind of a combative personality. As she's getting mugged, she basically says to, and she says to the men mugging her, you know, you think you're such a fucking big man, you know, beating up on a woman, you know, what the hell is that, sir? You stay so much in line, you don't even, you know, the Vex Corps, the corporation, doesn't even have to send cops down to take care of you. You know, what the fuck's wrong with you? I'm here trying to protect kids from cancer. And what she doesn't know is that the little sister of one of them just died of leukemia like 3 months before. So he gets really pissed off at her, and he beats her up, and he thinks about killing her, but he doesn't. And then he goes and talks to his brothers in the prison, and his brother says, you know, she's right, that you are just acting out this stuff. But what he says is, if you take some gunpowder and you put it on a table and you set a match to it, all you got is a stink in your house and a burn mark on the table. But if you put that behind a bullet, you got something. And his point is, direct your anger. And so he goes back to her office like 3 or 4 months later. He comes in. She's working late one night. And by now she's bought a gun to protect herself. He comes in late at night and walks into the door, and she sees him and pulls a gun on him. And he says, you know, I came to apologize. He's like, great, your apology accepted. Now get the hell out. It's like, no, you're right. It's like, fine, I'm right. Get the hell out of here. He goes, no, I thought about what you said, and you're right. So we did it. It's like, did what? He said, he's out in the trunk. I'm like, what? And ends up what they did is they kidnapped the CEO of the corporation, and they put him in the trunk. And she said, what'd you bring him here for? He's like, well, we figured you'd know what to do with him. I mean, you know, you were talking about how the whole system's messed up and how, you know, we need to strike back against the real oppressors, so here. So then she has a choice. She can either tell him to get lost, in which case she's showing that everything she's ever talked about is rhetoric, or she can participate in capital crime. And you learn this early in the book, but she goes ahead and participates. And then other stuff happens after that. But the point is, I think I think we always need to keep this class analysis, which, by the way, should also extend to an ecological analysis. I think we need to keep that in mind at every moment. And that's why I talk so often about a culture of resistance. And if Maud Gunn is just writing plays in Gaelic, it's like, I don't care. But if she does it, it's like, I did a talk in Bellingham, Washington about a year ago, and after the talk, there was one guy who was really pissed off. And it was great, because he was pissed off because, A, not many people had showed up, because the people who brought me had not done a very good promotional job, and B, he was pissed off because I came there for a day and then I left. And it's like, what are we supposed to do with this? And it's great, because what he did with that anger is he put together an organization called Fertile Ground that now they do explicitly above ground work, because there has to be a firewall between above ground and below ground work. You know, otherwise we should just go to the police station for recreational mugshots, you know? So there has to be a firewall. So they do above ground work, but everything they do is about forming this culture of resistance. And everything they do is about helping to bring this culture of resistance into being. And that's what we desperately need, is this whole culture of resistance. An example of this is IRB, Irish Peppermint Brotherhood, before the IRA. This guy does an action against the British, and he gets shot while he's doing the action. So he goes off and he falls down in an alley, and he gets away from the British. And some Irish men, they were, but Irish people, on their way home from work, they see him in the alley. And no questions asked, they pick him up and they take him to a doctor. And then the doctor fixes him, no questions asked, and then he's taken to a safe house. That's a culture of resistance. And those guys are doing it too. Those guys, and they're putting their lives on the line just as much as the guy who did, you know, what are they called, the 12 apostles or the 12 disciples? The assassins, the IRA assassins? I don't remember if it's 12 apostles or 12 disciples. But anyway, they had regular jobs. And what they would do is they would check in, they would clock into the job, and then they would go do the assassination of the British occupiers, and then they would go back to work. But you know what? They never clocked out. So they were at work the whole time, and all the other people on the line, no, man, he was working, he was right here next to me the whole time. They're taking their own lives. They could have been tortured and killed too. And we all need to enter into this culture of resistance. I mean, the world is being killed. What are they going to do? What are they going to do if they get mad at us? Kill it twice, you know? It's like, and so yes, as a man, I am very aware at every moment that I have male privilege. And you know what? I am going to use the hell out of that privilege to undercut its basis. And I'm going to use the fact, I interviewed a member of the MRTA, the Tupac Amaristas, years ago, in the 1990s. That's the Japanese group that took over the Japanese ambassador's house. I mean, the Peruvian group that took over the Japanese ambassador's house. I interviewed him, and I said, one of the things he said to me was, you've been privileged enough to learn how to write. Most of the people in the MRTA are not that rich. And so you need to use that. And he said also, by the way, there have been a lot of people who have picked up both the gun and the pen. I want to say one more thing about this, too, which I think might be the most important thing I say tonight, which if you're going to write anything down, write this down, which is the task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive authority. I'm sorry. The task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive power with as much integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to confront and take down systems of oppressive power. The task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive power with as much integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to confront and take down systems of oppressive power. And that can be done, once again, through undermining. That's why simple living as simple living, if that's the end of the story, it doesn't interest me at all. But simple living undermining, great. You got my vote for what that's worth. And, you know, because once again, we need it all. When I talk about we need to use any means necessary, I include bombs. I include guns. I include forks. I include non-forks. I include your hands. I include writing. I include pens. It's like, we need to... Andrea Dworkin. Andrea Dworkin has changed my life so much. Her analysis just blew me away. And without Andrea Dworkin's analysis, I would not be as good a feminist as I am. Without Jane Caputi's analysis. So that writing, even writing, I mean, writing is a pointless fucking waste of time. I mean, it doesn't accomplish anything in the real world. But it helps... Neil Everton's book, Natural Alien, changed my life. It saved my life. It saved my sanity, you know? And we can build on those, and we have to build on those. And that includes Marx, obviously. I mean, all that, and Class Analysis Central. And also, one more thing that's very important, which is that I was reading this book on an autobiography of a member of the Dutch resistance in World War II, and there was one line of it that just blew me away, which was, it's a direct quote, "The resistance was, of course, made up primarily of murderers, prostitutes, and thieves." World War II resistance. That blew me away because I always thought that the resistance was made up of upper-class British officers like Ingrid Bergman's husband in Casablanca. I mean, that's what the propaganda is. But then I read it. I was like, of course. And, I mean, of course it would be because they didn't care about Dutch law, so of course they're not going to care about German law. And there's I was talking to Christopher Hedges a couple weeks ago, and he said, "Oh, that I said that line." He said, "Absolutely, it's true." He's been a war correspondent. He said, "El Salvador, the resistance was primarily the criminal class, whatever that means. Hamas is primarily made up of criminals." And this leads to a huge question of, and it's not an either or, but it's something I think about a lot: do we want to radicalize militants or militantize radicals? It's a hugely important question. The Black Panthers ask that question all the time. You know, I have talked with radicalized former drug dealers. They are so comfortable with guns, you know? And, I mean, there was a guy I was talking to that's like, when he used to do drug deals, and he's been to prison and he's out, so he can talk about whatever he wants now. But, you know, it's like they do a drug deal, everybody walks in, they put their gun on the table. And, like, this guy came in one time, didn't put a gun on the table. He said to the guy, "Put your gun on the table." And the guy said, "I didn't bring one." He said, "Okay, either A, you're really stupid, or B, you're a liar, in which case, either case, I don't want to deal with you." And he just walked out. And... I mean, can you imagine? It's like when the guy down in Arizona went to the Obama's talk and he had the automatic weapons. All my friends were saying, "Where are the lefties with the automatic weapons? You know, why is it all only the right wingers and are the gun nuts?" You know, I saw this woman had a shirt that said "Tree hugging gun lover, tree loving gun nut," something like that. And it's great. You know, it's like, and when this would have been part of the regular Endgame talk that when I used to, one of the reasons I wrote Endgame is because when I used to do talks about fighting back, the response by people in the audience was so predictable, which is, if I talk about fighting back, by which I can mean, you know, fighting back including filing lawsuits and everything, but also in this case, I mean fighting back means militant. And when I would talk about fighting back, the response to that was really predictable, which is sort of mainstream peace and social justice activists and mainstream environmental activists would put up what I've taken to calling a Gandhi shield, which is they would say names Martin Luther King, Dalai Lama, and Gandhi again really fast over and over to keep all evil thoughts at bay. And then the grassroots activists would do the same thing, but then they would come up to me afterwards and they would whisper in my ear, "Thank you so much for bringing this up." And then there were other groups of people that had different responses, and that is a lot of people of color, a lot of the poor, a lot of gang kids, a lot of American Indians, survivors of domestic violence, family farmers. I don't know if I already mentioned radical environmentalists. A lot of them would say, "Yeah, tell us something we don't know. Let's go, bro." And what I realized is that for a lot of the latter groups, violence is not some spiritual abstract question to be puzzled through. It's not a capital V violence. It's not reified. It's part of life. You deal with it. Doesn't mean you do it. Doesn't mean you don't do it. But you deal. And I bring this up in terms of class because it's a hugely important class. There's a great line by the last poets: "Don't talk to me of revolution until you're ready to eat rats to survive." And when I did the talk in Chico a couple days ago, one of the questions from the audience was, how can we get people to fight back, literally, to save what's left of the planet when we ourselves are so insulated? You know, it's left to the tribes in the Amazon to actually kill cops with spears when they're getting shot. You know, that sort of courage. Or men, like I mentioned earlier, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta has reduced oil production by 20%. And these are a bunch of half-starved people who, they don't have the luxuries that we have. And is that what it's going to take, is sloshing through oil muck before we will fight back? And what will it take for us to fight back? And that question that woman asked me at the talk in Portland about, so who is going to take out the dams? That's the question. Who will do it? Who will do it? And it's like Michael Collins in the movie, which is great except for the love triangle. There's a part where he's standing up and he's talking against the British, and you know, he says, "The British are going to take me out." It was the Irish who took him out, which is a horizontal hostility, which is something else we can talk about. But anyway, he says, "When I get taken out, who will take my place?" And one of the important things, one of the reasons that those in power have been able to kill so much of the planet, there's this great line by Thomas Jefferson talking about the Indians. He said, "In war, they may kill some of us, we shall destroy all of them." That's it. That's why they always win. Because they have that level of fucking determination. And us, it's like, oh, I might get hurt. And there's that level of intensity. What would happen? I mean, think about this. If there's a protest, you know, there might be one person throw something at a cop, but what is the attitude of the cops? The attitude of the cops is, you know what? You may hit one of us with a rock, we're going to take out every fucking one of you. That's the attitude they have every time. What if we had that attitude and we had zero tolerance? What if we, in our communities, said we are going to enforce cancer-free zones? What if we said we are going to enforce rape-free zones? How many people in here have heard of the Gulabi Gang? The Pink Sari Gang? Aren't they great? They're amazing. There's this group of women in India that they wear pink saris and they take, they do martial arts. They go through the villages, and if they see a man beating up a woman, they beat the shit out of him. This is happening right now with the Gulabi Gang. This happened in Maoist China right after the revolution. There were women who would go through the villages, and they would say, if they saw a man beating up a woman, they'd beat the shit out of him. If they saw him do it again, they'd kill him. We cannot count on the police to protect us. 6% of men who commit rape spend even one night in jail. And we can't count on the police to protect us from cancer. It's their job to enforce the dictates of capital, as you know, which means it falls to us. And then the question is, and people have said, "God, Derek, you can't take out a dam, because if you take out a dam, they're just going to put it up again." That is such bullshit. What would happen if we were members of the Russian resistance in World War II, and the Germans build a warehouse? What do? We burn it down. What do the Germans do? They build it up. What do we do as members of resistance? And then they build it again. What do we do then? And then they build it again. What do we do then? And then we get sick of that, then we just kill the Germans. But the point is, we need to match their intensity. Those on the other side know what they want. They want every last fish in the ocean. They want every last tree. And we need to match that, and we need to say, this is where I live. And this is, actually, there's something, there's something I would like to read. Are you okay with closing here? Or do you want to keep going? Either way is okay with me. Because I have a good thing to close with if we're going to close.
But before you close, may I ask a question?
Okay, I'm going to say this and then we won't close. How's that? Because I want to read this because it really applies to this. And this is how I usually close my talks. A few of the bravest Cheyenne dog soldiers will be chosen to wear sashes of tan skins called dog ropes. Attached to each dog rope is a picket pin, normally used to tether horses. During battle, the pin would be driven into the ground as a mark of resolve. Once the pin was driven, the dog soldier would remain staked to that piece of ground even to the end, even to the death. Retreat was no longer an option. The pin could only be removed when everyone was again safe or when another dog soldier relieved him of his duty. It is time. I have driven my picket pin. I am staked out and willing to give in no more. Where will you drive your own picket stake? Where will you choose to make your stand? Give me a threshold, a specific point at which you finally stop running, at which you finally fight back. Stand with me. Stand and fight. I am one, we would be two. Two more might join and we would be four. When four more join, we will be eight, and we'll be eight people fighting whom others will join, and then more people, and more. Stand and fight. The questions before each of us now are, what are your gifts and how can you use them in the service of your land base? What can you do? What does your land base most need from you? How can you achieve it? What do you want to do? And right now, perhaps the most important of all, what are you willing to do? So, a question?
My question is really practical, actually. Can you just address how the state has developed techniques and over the years and learned over the years, over the centuries, really, how to oppress resistance and revolution? For example, someone pointed out there's a camera in here, and you mentioned that the nun, her bank account, the money was taken out of it, and, you know, through our cell phones and our credit cards and things, we're being kept track of all the time. So can you just address how that, we need to keep that in mind with also building a resistance?
I think, how many people in here know the concept of the panopticon? Okay, very important concept. I'm sorry?
Very postmodern. Foucault.
I learned a lot from Foucault on that. Well, for those of you who don't, the panopticon is a prison design that is where you have the central guard tower and then all the cells are radial from there. And what this means is that if the guard tower is always kept dark and the cells are kept lit, it means that the guard tower, it's that the surveillance is, in Foucault's word, always possible, never verifiable, which means there may be a guard there, but you can't tell if you're a prisoner when they're looking at you. So we can't tell if they're looking at us, okay? And what this means is very effective, not just a prison design, but as a way to design society, because you never know when they're looking at you, so you police yourselves. It's like Stephen Biko said, that the most powerful tool in the hand of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. And so we police ourselves. But there's also a South African security, head of security for South Africa during apartheid said that the thing they were afraid most of from the ANC was not the sabotage or even the violence, as it was that the mass of South Africans would learn to not respect law and order as such, because there is no security force in the world that can stand up to people who don't believe that there is a relationship between law and morality, who don't believe that laws must be followed simply because they're laws. What are laws? Laws are rules made by the rich for the rich. And there are, I'm not saying we shouldn't have laws against rape. I got no problem with laws against rape. It'd be nice if they were enforced, actually. But we have to recognize that there is not a correspondence between law and morality, and we need to break away from that. And then we can act practically. And then there are questions. How do you organize within a panopticon? We all have to take different approaches to that. My own approach is because, okay, I am above ground, and I don't break the law, except sometimes I shoplift dog food from Walmart, and that's like a sacrament. But apart from that, I don't break the law. And one of the reasons is because I have a big bullseye on my chest. After a talk I did one time, this guy shook my hand, and I took my hand away. There's a little piece of paper in it that said, after the talk, let's go fuck some shit up in the parking lot. And it's like, you are not getting me that easy, Mr. Fed Man. You know, I'm not that stupid. So there have to be, one of the things we have to do is to start instituting, within a panopticon especially, instituting good security culture rules. People know about the Green Scare. The victims of the Green Scare, okay, the non-cooperating defendants, I will never say anything against them. The non-cooperating defendants were very courageous, and I support them as a member of the above ground. As a member of the above ground, what we need to provide to below ground people is material support and loyalty. And we need, those of us above ground need to speak out as often as we can, as explicitly and forcefully as we can, at every moment. And the people below ground, okay, having said I'm not going to say anything bad about the non-cooperating defendants, which I'm not, there were some mistakes made in the whole Green Scare thing. One of the reasons it fell apart is because one of the people in our group was a heroin addict. I'm not saying all heroin addicts are bad, but I'm saying, are you going to trust your life to a heroin addict? They did. Many of them were sleeping with each other. And that ended up being used by the feds. One of the tape recordings was of two of the guys talking to each other. One of them saying to the other one, yeah, she's kind of fat. And the other one saying, she's really bad in bed, too. And they played this for the woman. I mean, she wants to protect those guys after that? I mean, and plus, you know, relationships, romantic relationships can get messy anyway. So let's add, and then you're living underground, all this stuff. It's like, that adds a layer of complexity. I'm not saying people shouldn't sleep with each other. I'm saying that triangulation can get really messy in a situation like that. More people knew about actions than should have known. Oh, they talked about actions after they were done. The way it fell apart was Jake, the snitch, who has had nothing happen to him, by the way. Jake, the snitch, went to the cops and then after that put on a wire and went to his friends and said, or his ex-friends, went to the other Green Scare people and said, hey, remember when we did this? Remember the good old days? And they should have said, Jake, what are you talking about? You must have been high, you know? I never went out there. What are you talking about? You know, it's like, don't talk about this stuff. Need to know basis. It's like, also, if you want to know, here's my real answer. I can say this easily in California. I don't know about Connecticut, but I live in Northern California. Do the words Northern California and marijuana happen to go together for anybody here? It's like, it's not possible to live in Northern California without knowing somebody who is involved. One out of every six houses in Arcata is a grow house. That's not an exaggeration. And so one of the things I think, and so I can easily say in California, if you want to know how to communicate and organize within a panopticon, talk to your neighbor because they're probably a grower, you know? It's like, talk to growers and find out how they organize, how they communicate. It's cool. I get to ask anybody anything, you know? I'll use it in a book or something. And as long as it's like, how do you communicate that you're going to transport? So I was like, well, I think, you know, I was wondering if you could bring down like 4 cakes for the birthday party next week. It's like, yeah, so do you want like Afghan cakes or would you rather have a train wreck cake? You know, it's like, or how about a purple granddaddy cake? You want one of those? But so this point is, you know, they develop a language that allows them to communicate within the panopticon. And so I would look to criminal organizations of various sorts. And also, if you're going to consider organizing underground, ask yourself, would I trust my life to this person? Because that's what you're doing. And, you know, when I ask myself that in my own life, there's probably only a couple, 3 people I would trust my life to. Because a lot of the people, the Green Scare people, have gone away for 20 years. And that's a big chunk of your life. And so how do you know who to trust? You got to think about this. It's like, are they, how do they get vouched for? You know, we don't right now have the luxury. The way they do this in real resistance movements is give somebody a gun and say, okay, go kill a member of the opposition. That's how they did in the World War II resistance against Germans. Go shoot a German. Real easy. German guy's not going to do it. German woman probably wouldn't do it either. And so the point is that, how do you trust the people? You know, it's like, I think we can say that I'm not a Fed. If I'm a Fed, I've written 15 books. It's like, that's really fucking deep cover. that doesn't mean you have to trust me. You know, I may be a wimp and I may turn. As soon as the cops put me in the car, I may turn. So you can't trust me for that reason. But you can say I'm not a Fed. Okay, so now you could probably say my mom's not a Fed because, you know, I would know. You see what I'm saying? So how do you know who to trust? You have to think about these things. And I did an interview with a pacifist one time, which was a big mistake. And one of the things he said in his inaccurate write-up was, it seems like Derek wants for all activists to think like assassins. And that's not true. I only want for some activists to think like assassins. And what I want is for all activists to think like members of a serious resistance. And what does that mean? One of the things it means is paying attention to the panopticon, not letting the panopticon scare you. You know, I haven't said it tonight, but a lot of times on my talks I say, you know, for the undercover Fed agent in the audience, I have a couple things to say to you. One of them is, fuck you. And the other one is, I want for it to be known publicly that what you're doing is wrong. And when Adolf Eichmann was on trial for his life in Jerusalem, part of his defense was that nobody ever told him what he was doing was wrong. Well, I'm telling you what you're doing is wrong. I'm telling you in public. And I'm telling you that at some point you will be held accountable for your crimes against humanity and in the favor of corporations. I say that publicly because I'm above ground. So it's my job to put on a big fucking bullseye. But below ground, I got a friend who says, if you want to be a revolutionary, don't look like one. He wears suits and ties. You know? It's like, your job, it depends on the rule. How do you organize underground? Ask marijuana growers. And you know what? If they have good security, they won't tell you. Ha. They'll say, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't smoke. Oh, I want to say one more thing about marijuana. I got to tell you a story. I love this story. I live in Northern California, obviously. And there was a great example of participatory democracy happened about a year ago. What?
I have to get home.
Okay. We're probably about done anyway.
It's 10 after 10.
Okay. Anyway, this is a story of participatory democracy having to do with marijuana, which is that the county where I live, everybody knows about Prop 215 in California? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Prop 215 says you can grow and possess small amounts of marijuana for personal medicinal use. And it's determined by the county how much you get to have. And Del Norte, the county where I live, the rule used to be that you could have up to 99 plants. And there are those who said that somehow 99 plants is too much for personal medicinal use. And so the county was going to reduce it to 6 plants. The Board of Supervisors, that's the county commission, I don't know what we have here, but at home it's the Board of Supervisors. Anyway, so they were going to reduce it to 6 plants. The county turned out en masse. This was participatory democracy in action. The place was absolutely packed. If the Board of Supervisors would have reduced it to 6, they would have been killed that night. You know, this is what participatory democracy is supposed to look like. They said, fuck no, you are not taking our marijuana away from us. And that's the good news. The bad news is I wish that they would do the same thing for the salmon. You know, I wish they loved salmon as much as they love marijuana. When they are going to do something to salmon, you know, there's 4 people show up, and it's the same 4 people who showed up to protest the war. But anyway, that's the answer. Do you want to quit or do you want to do any more?
I'm tired too.
Wait. You were going to ask a question a while ago. So your last question, is that okay? Is it a good ending question?
It was a response to the kiddos thinking about Dark and you already laughed.
Please laugh. So anybody have a good ending question? You, because he's the relative of one of my neighbors, so he gets special treatment.
It's actually not even a question. It was just a statement that I think everybody here should be aware of, keeping in mind of like the panopticon and whatnot. It is a good idea to read the news about certain criminal trials. For instance, you can find out that if the feds decide it, if you have a battery in your cell phone, they can tape it. They can record what you're saying. It doesn't matter if the phone's on or not. And things like that, I think, are really important to realize. I mean, we're all like, oh, the security camera. Meanwhile, we all got cell phones, so who gives a shit if the camera's on? You know, they can hear every word. So I think it is very important. Even if you're above ground, below ground, you know, whatever you're doing, I think it is really important to just be aware of these things. And I found out by reading an article about a mob case that happened, and that's how they got them.
That's right, and it's absolutely crucial. People should always think security culture, security culture, security culture. You see, above ground groups sometimes fall apart because different people accuse each other of being snitches. That's one of the things. I got accused of being a snitch not very long ago, and it's really stupid because, like, there's right now there's an entirely above ground organization in Humboldt County that's falling apart because they're accusing each other of being snitches. It's like, wait, you're an above ground organization. It doesn't matter if there's snitches here. Because what do? You're having fucking bake sales, you know? It's like.
Well, but it's brownie bake sales.
Yeah, it's brownie. Yeah. And so Yeah, if you're below ground, that's one thing. If you're above ground, I mean, it really doesn't matter if there is a Fed here tonight, because none of us have said anything illegal. And you know what? Anybody who says anything actually illegal in here tonight is stupid. They should fucking go to prison. You know, it's like, you should go to prison for being stupid, you know? So we need to always keep in mind security culture. And if you're, another thing is the Black Panthers. There are a lot of those who are in prison who said, when I joined the Panthers, I knew I was either going to end up dead or in prison. And so if you go underground, you know, recognize that's one of the problems with the Green Scare is some of them, absolutely dedicated, not saying anything against them, Stan, I will be glad to say things against, fucking snitch, he snitched within 30 seconds of being in the cop car. He got in the cop car and he turned. Clearly, he had not recognized that if you burn down federal facilities, you're committing a crime. And you need to be aware that those in power will do something to you if you commit crimes they don't like. And so if you're going to, that's another thing. This is not a game. The world is being killed. We need to fight back. We need to make a culture of resistance. We need to, and we need to live our own lives as if our own lives matter. That's what all this has to do with what's real, you know? Live your own life as if your own life is real and meaningful. And then also fight back, because your own life and the lives of others depend on it.
Absolutely. That's what the whole integrity thing. I mean, that whole alignment. That's where the power comes from. I mean, the power comes from that alignment of what you believe. I always tell people, if you believe that you need to recycle and you don't recycle, ooh. You know, you can see people's energy just dripping off. I can see it just dripping off of their body. And they'll throw recycling over to me and I say, look, I already recycle. I already got my power on that. I don't need to worry about it. That's why every little thing you do every day is this power thing, you know. And I think it's great, obviously. But and when you have integrity, it's just cool, because people can't say to you, well, you shouldn't do this, or you shouldn't do that, or whatever, because like you know what you're doing. And I didn't get this till much later in life, but it's great to just know what you're doing. And people can't say, oh, you can't do that, or you didn't do that, and it's your personal experience. They can't say that. When you have personal experience, nobody can tell you that that's not true. Nobody can say you didn't have that experience. Nobody. I don't care who it is. And it's a very powerful way to live.
Which doesn't mean that you can't be a hypocrite.
Oh.
Because we're all hypocrites. Yeah, absolutely. I did this great, we don't have time to do it, but I did this great thing in Chico the other day, which is we all went around the room, it's like 50 of us, we all went around the room saying the things that we do that are impure, and not saying like confessional, but it's like, I love potato chips. Like, especially potato chips made in lard. I can hold a bag. I like playing Half-Life 2. Pretty damn good game. I like betting on professional sports. You know, so fucking what? I mean, that doesn't mean that I'm not going to bring down the whole fucking culture. You know, so it's like, that's another thing they do is they get us. I'm not saying we should, but of course we have, but that's because I have integrity on that, because it's like, I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I can't throw away paper that hasn't been written on every little itty bit because I
can see that.
Yeah. And so what's the point? The point is that that we shouldn't feel like hypocrites also, because we have to somehow, on some level, participate in the system that was foisted upon us. What we need to do is to move through that system with as much integrity as we can, and at the same time recognize, I didn't make this system, and I need to bring it down.
You can grow tomatoes and throw rocks.
Which is a great note to end on. We need to thank Stephanie one more time, because she did this all by herself.